compared to some of those larger institutions that have been going 100 years, it does very much feel like we are still inventing the future path.
Hello everybody, welcome to this episode of Media Voices, the last before we go on a 4-week summer break.
Holiday!
I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
I'm Peter Houston.
That quote you just heard was from Chris Waiting, who's chief exec of The Conversation UK. We chatted about what lessons his team is taking forward from its record-breaking corona coverage, why newsletters and live events are its focus for the near future, and what other news publishers can learn from its policy of marrying journalistic flair with scholarly insight. But ahead of that, as ever, we're going to do our news roundup.
Well, this is why we need a holiday, right?
So I suppose, Peter, you're our music guy. Why don't you take us through this first one?
Well, Q Magazine closing after 34 years. To me, anyway, there was an inevitability about this when Bauer announced that they'd put these magazines under review. The print circulation was dropping. But it was just sad. There was a lot of reaction to it, of how important Q had been. Ted Kepler, the editor. You know, the saddest thing, I think, was when he apologised for his failure to keep Q open. And I think when you see these numpties saying, oh, hey, another magazine's gone, another newspaper's gone, less journalists and all, blah, blah, blah.
But the fact he said, like, for the whole time he's been there, they've had to be, like, this really lean operation. Like, they've been having to constantly find savings and constantly cutting costs. And
I think he's been the editor for something like a decade, something like that.
What a fascinating decade to have seen, though, the rise of streaming music, which I suppose actually did impact their business model after a while. People don't need to come to your magazine for discovery, so it has to become a bit of a bit more interview-led, if you see what I mean, a bit more insight-driven.
You know, I remember talking to Scott Rowley about this, about who they would put on the cover, and big names get newsstand sales, so that's why there's so many covers with the Beatles on, or AC/DC, or Liam Gallagher. So, yeah, I get that criticism, but I don't know. There's that quality music journalism, that real insight. It's just one less place you can go to find that. I mean, your circulation's gone from like 200,000 to 28,000 in a decade.
Yeah, I know.
You're going in the wrong direction.
You're talking about inevitability there. Esther, what happened at Immedia?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this only broke on Friday, so we're not actually 100% sure yet. But I think we'd all seen a couple of people at Immedia, announce that they've been laid off during the week, which is really sad. It turns out that they're now closing 12 magazines and cutting 113 jobs thanks to coronavirus. Like many subscription publishers, they've seen really, really impressive growth in print subscriptions and the digital audiences during the pandemic, but it's just not enough to offset the ad market downturn and falling newsstand sales.
When I saw this originally, I thought it was actually just a kind of staff consolidation. I didn't realise that the magazines were closing.
I would have expected the hobby magazines to be useful at this point in time. You've got ones like Essential Kitchen, Bathroom, Bedroom that are closing. Well, right now, tons of people are doing DIY projects in their kitchens, bathrooms and bedrooms because they've got nothing to spend their holiday money on. I've seen so much about the number of people that are taking up knitting and cross stitch and all these little hobbies because we've been stuck inside. So it's just really sad that even that can't keep them going.
But those are quite new to Immedia. They had bought them from Burda. So I guess they maybe hadn't, they hadn't started that whole integration thing, and I don't know, maybe just seemed like investment.
Now more than ever, we need magazines about mindfulness. And which one are they axing? And what about mindfulness?
And in Bauer Australia, they've axed 8 mags as well. So Harper's Bazaar, Elle, InStyle, Men's Health, basically a bunch of the mass market titles, including OK. They've all been axed. And the new owners, Mercury Capital, are similarly citing that catastrophic drop in ad revenue. Peter, can I ask you to be cynical about this one, please?
Well,
try really, really hard, Peter.
Okay.
I know it's alien to you.
Well, to me, Immedia's maybe a different story, but Mercury Capital file this under don't let a good crisis go to waste. Because these guys have just gone, oh, well, the P&L, as they count the beans out, as they've looked at the P&L, they said, nah, these aren't working for us. We've invested. We don't see a return. Kill these. They don't give a shit about the long-term prospects of these titles. And they'll bin them as quick as anything, and they'll blame whatever they can blame. So I don't know. This one's slightly different for me. And, you know, even with the media, are they looking at the bottom line and saying, well, you know what, these aren't really going to work for us? They've said in the releases from immediate, they said, we're doing this for the long-term benefit of the company. And I get that. But someone like Mercury Capital, they're just looking for a return and they didn't see it. Go on then, silver linings.
So there are a couple of launches here. So Future is launching 3 digital titles. So Esther, why don't you take us through which titles they are launching? And then Peter, you can go back to being cynical.
Yeah, so they've, and actually I have to say, I'm impressed at the speed at which they've done this. They've spun up 3 new, well, I suppose digital titles, essentially websites, isn't it really? So they've got gardeningetc.com, which I think it's going to be a spin-off of their home brand Living Etc. So yeah, that's going to be all about the garden sector, including garden designs. They've also launched fitandwell.com, which is going to be a digital wellness brand for the post-COVID-19 era. Interestingly, they've said they're particularly aiming at the active aging segment. I'm trying to think if I know anybody who's recently taken up running.
Yay!
So yeah, senior citizens who are looking to get a bit more active, they're aiming at that.
I can believe this. Do you remember it was like the 90s, there was a glut of VHSs that were just like, keep arthritis at bay, and it was instructional videos aimed at the elderly. And I can see this very well fitting that
senior
niche.
Senior citizens, elderly, what the actual...
I'm not talking about you. I'm literally talking about people who were elderly in the 90s.
I just did 5K in 32 minutes.
To be fair, I couldn't do 5K, so all due respect. But anyway, I think their targeting here is quite clever. And I don't know if you two have seen this this infographic circulating on Twitter this week about where most of the money of the generations are sitting. And the boomers have got all of it. So yeah. It's like,
I'm not a boomer.
If you're wanting to target a group of people, go for the top end boomers, because they're the ones that are sitting on most of the country's money. So.
God, I wish I was a boomer then.
I'd like to target boomers.
Anyway. They've also launched, this is the one that baffles me a little bit, whattowatch.com. I mean, I don't tell you how much that URL cost. Which is going to help users binge smarter.
I don't understand.
And that is the most ridiculous strapline I have ever heard.
It's designed to guide consumers through today's confusing video programming choices. Who calls it a video program anymore?
Yeah, that's true. But you know what? That makes sense to me. Discovery is a huge issue on like Amazon Prime and Netflix. You basically only get the preview. You don't know much about it beyond that on the platform itself. But there are endless options for this already that are better established.
I mean, even BuzzFeed, like twice every couple of weeks, like 2 or 3 times a week, does this whole kind of what to watch on Netflix this week kind of thing. There's so many places doing this.
Everybody does that. Everybody does that.
God, I've just been editing an interview with Terry White about the Pilot podcast. Pilot's been doing this for a while. I think that's quite a brave one. Stop and being cynical for a second. Esther's point about speed to market is absolutely spot on here. These guys are just on this.
Yeah, well, it's the group MD, Andrea Davies, who said in the press release that they were watching the search trends and that they basically just launched these in a matter of weeks based on what people are searching for. If you've got an organisation that can do that, that's pretty good going.
The only thing I'd say about that is what happens when we go back to whatever normal looks like. I'm struggling to balance my respect and cynicism here. That the Vogue business announcement on this is insanely honest. It's like, we're launching this in Scandinavia because these guys have got a great economic outlook and there's more millionaires per head in Scandinavia than pretty much anywhere outside the Middle East. So we're launching a magazine. Thanks, guys. It's just... there's a lot less about the ethos of Vogue and, they talk about style and Scandinavian style, and that's obvious. But they're pretty much saying there's a bunch of rich people in Scandinavia and that's why we're launching a magazine.
I'm kind of shocked that they weren't there already.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised that there wasn't already a Vogue Scandinavia.
Yeah, I appreciate that honesty. I really do. In an age where it's like, everything's got to be dressed up in purpose and everything. I like them going, people buy this because there's a shitload of money.
Yeah, no, I like it. That's totally right. It's...
But this one I think is fun. So, Pint Size Punk. It's a 10-year-old's lockdown project was to create this punk magazine.
So this kid is so into his music. And his mom is, I guess she was a teacher and has got a tutoring business. She thought, well, how can I do this homeschooling thing? I know, let's do a magazine. And what's so brilliant about this is he, Arlo, explains how making a magazine fits in with his schoolwork. He says, well, the writing was English, and then I had to figure out the costs, and that's maths. And then I had to design it, so that's ICT. It's just brilliant the way he talks about this. So that's the one side of it. But the other side of it is like he's got interviews with the Manics and Super Furry Animals and stuff. He's been on Lauren Laverne on BBC Six Music. He was on Five Live. It's just mental. Listening to him talking about this project reminded me so much of why magazines are so awesome. It was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. There's a serious point, which is this where we're all going to end up? Are we all going to end up working in this farmer's market of magazines? You know, competing with 10-year-olds who are doing a better job than we are because of the passion and the niche focus. But it was just brilliant. Also, the fact that it's, you know, my big tweet on this one was, never mind, print's not dead, punk's not dead.
Yeah, you like that.
That's the best, but...
That point about the farmers market is interesting, though, because I just as we began this, I was looking on Twitter and I saw that somebody has kickstarted a. They're basically their dream magazine since they were a kid. It's called Ninty Fresh, and it's a Nintendo focused magazine. It reminded me of Thomas Bechdel's article about why now is the time to launch a magazine, particularly as a kind of indie creator.
Yeah, and I mean you've got, I know Simon Brewer at Film Stories. He's running another Kickstarter to bring a bit more in for his. You know, I mean, Film Stories is basically his passion project.
If anything, this is kind of inspirational. It's aspirational as well. It's the idea that maybe it's not going to be on newsstands, but you can have your own magazine. The print costs are still exorbitant, but you can do it and you can make it work.
It's just so joyful watching this. You know, watching Arlo, the 10-year-old magazine publisher, talk about this is just brilliant.
Well, now onto news in brief, and as Esther has very rightly pointed out here, it's not just print that's feeling the pain, because BuzzFeed have laid off 50 of the 74 employees who were furloughed in the spring. BuzzFeed are basically attributing this to losing custom advertising deals, as well as Amazon pausing their affiliate deals. And basically, Amazon pulled back on everything they were doing with affiliate revenue anyway, so there's no guarantee that that's going to come back in the future.
So this is a tough one to talk about. Troy Young, the president of Hearst Magazines, has resigned after being the subject of a recent New York Times expose into alleged lewd comments and other inappropriate behaviour. So why I think it's difficult is we've talked about Troy Young in the past as, you know, really giving him credit for turning Hearst around. Hearst, one of the publishers that hasn't been crushed by the pandemic. I don't think they've had layoffs particularly. I think they paid a bonus at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And then it, you know, basically comes out that Troy Young is a bit of a dick. He may have done all this great stuff, but the cost of that is he's a bully. The one thing it makes me sort of want to say is, if you're running a company, don't be a dick.
I suppose the difficulty here, though, is that in the past, the whole media industry has rewarded being a dick. So you've suddenly got all these people at the top. I'm not saying everybody at the top is a dick, but you've got all these people at the top who've got there because the industry has rewarded the behaviour that's got them there.
Yeah. It's not even like rewarded. It's fated. People go, oh, what a character.
Yeah.
Oh, it's that kind of, you know, that driven personality.
But I guess world politics is the kind of pinnacle of this at the moment.
Was that not somebody's motto? Oh, no, it's Wheaton's Law. There you go. It's Will Wheaton.
Oh, yes. I'm so pleased because I love Will Wheaton.
Well, it's Will Wheaton's Law. Don't be a dick.
Excellent.
And DMGT's titles have returned to profit in June after seeing a 45% drop in ad revenue during lockdown. I think revenue overall is still down about 30% for the quarter. But, the online growth, especially to mail online, has been really strong. So that's up 37% year on year. So that's, I mean, that's a swings and roundabouts story.
And we mentioned it slightly earlier, but subscriptions are up for Dennis Publishing. So rates across all titles have increased by 9% overall since the start of the pandemic. The Week Junior, in particular, has benefited with circulation growing 23%. that is right place, right time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Launching something that educates children at a time when basically schools are just like, no, get the fuck out of here.
No, that's their UK magazine. That's their UK one that's grown 23%.
As well as Cyclist magazine, which has seen subscriptions grow 39% since January.
That is due to loads of people wanting to go out and cycle and not be able to cycle.
Another nice little story, Morning Brew newsletter, which used to be just a newsletter, will bring in $20 million in revenue this year. So this, you know, this company, which started off with a daily newsletter, now has 45 staff, publishes 4 newsletters and 4 verticals. So
are we looking at our future here?
Yeah, maybe. General business, retail, emerging tech, marketing. So they've got these verticals. And then they do a podcast, and they're going to pull down $20 million in revenue this year. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Josh Sternberg reported on that. He'd interviewed the CEO.
And some more good news. Podcast downloads have returned to their pre-COVID levels, according to Chartable. So they tracked 825 million downloads in June, which is up from 600 million in March. And even better news, ad spend has actually kept up and the market's expected to grow 15% this year despite disruption.
Speaking of podcasts, the NYT is acquiring Serial Productions, which is the maker of the most popular podcast ever, even though I don't particularly like it, in its latest move to grow its podcast business. There's a good explainer, which we'll link in the show notes. This was announced a couple of weeks ago, unless I dreamed it. An indication of how much the NYT actually values its podcasts on the back of the daily and everything.
In utterly shocking news you will not believe, I love these headlines, the Taboola Outbrain merger has been allowed to go ahead after the Justice Department decided not to challenge it on an antitrust basis. And for those of you not familiar with Taboola and Outbrain, they're those garbage so-called chum boxes. Of crap at the bottom of publishers' judgy articles. I'm very, very judgy.
I told you, before, I think I've said it on the podcast before, I interviewed Adamson Golder for the media briefing years ago, and he was the loveliest, smartest man ever. He was just so nice.
But look at what he's unleashed on the internet.
Well, that's exactly it. Do you remember when we did our 100th episode, I compared him to John Hammond from Jurassic Park? So this week I spoke with Chris Waiting, who's chief exec of The Conversation UK. We spoke about what other publications can learn about membership building from its expert-oriented publishing method, but first I asked him how his time at the BBC and the Associated Press prepared him for the role.
For as long as I've worked in media, there's always been a very strong theme of public service media. The BBC, obviously, with its public service broadcasting remit. The Associated Press, although it's perhaps not as well known, particularly not in the UK, is a member-owned not-for-profit cooperative. And in its founding documents, the AP being about 160 years old, it exists to uphold the First Amendment of the US Constitution of access to a free and fair press. And so I think that those sort of values have always been really important to me. And so I was fortunate to be introduced to The Conversation while I was at AP. We had a partnership with them in the US. And then it just so happened that my former boss at the BBC, Caroline Thompson, is one of the trustees of the Conversation in the UK. And so was able to connect me when they were looking for a new chief executive. And so it felt like a perfect match of my interests in public service media, along with the opportunity to really grow something that was quite a new business and doing things in a very different way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's almost, well, that's serendipity in action really there. But how much of that entrepreneurial spirit, I suppose, remains at The Conversation? It has been around for, I mean, it's a fixture now of kind of the digital media landscape.
I think so, that these things can sometimes feel different on the inside than the outside. That yes, as you know, we've been going 7, coming up on 8 years in the UK, and actually, that does make us quite almost establishment as digital news publishers go. But compared to some of those larger institutions that have been going 100 years, it does very much feel like we are still inventing the future path.
I've seen the stats that kind of has been sent over, and as you mentioned, it's doubled and it's doubled again as a result of, I suppose, some very some very strong performances on COVID-related content for you. So is that necessarily, do you see that as an opportunity, or is this almost, will we see a reversion to the mean here where people stop looking for COVID-related content, or will they continue to focus on expert insight and everything as the conversation provides?
I mean, I think in some ways almost all of those things. That early in the crisis, I tried to avoid the word opportunity, because you could see quite how challenging this was going to be for the whole news ecosystem. And I could see that we were very fortunate that because of the way that we're funded, we're a charity, and as I mentioned, the bulk of our funding comes from universities. We weren't facing a cliff edge in the same way as a lot of other publishers. And so it slightly felt wrong to describe it as an opportunity.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
At the same time, it did feel like it was a moment. That one of my frustrations in the last few years has been that as we've covered elections and other moments, that there hasn't been a step change in the public suddenly saying, actually, I want to hear from experts. I don't want politicians. I want somebody who really understands what they're talking about. And it was different this time, that from February or March, that we saw our traffic go through the roof, because everything was changing and nobody knew what was going on. And so the public was just really hungry to have experts not only explain the current moment, but to put it in context. Traffic has come down slightly from that high that, you know, in March, our stories were read 100 million times globally. And that sort of ticked down to, I think, about 70 million now. I hope that we've been engaging with them, trying to encourage them to subscribe to our newsletter, our podcasts, and so on, yeah. That we'll be able to retain some of those, that they'll have recognised that we're a place that they enjoy visiting regularly. And so, yes, it's sort of approaching it as both a publisher and as a provider of information.
You didn't want to describe it as an opportunity, and obviously your funding methods are very, very different than a lot of the publications that are out there. But do you feel then that by presenting the stories as you do and putting them in that wider context, that you're almost providing a model for how, you know, expert insight can be communicated to the general public?
I think so. That there are probably a lot of things that other bits of the media could learn from us, and indeed that the academics and universities can learn from us as well. That at the heart of our model is a partnership between an academic and a journalist. That yeah. While when you come to our site and you read any of the stories, the byline you see on the story is the academic who wrote it. You see bits of the media saying that academics are sometimes a bit woolly and inconclusive and put too many caveats on their story. They bury the lead. Whereas a lot of academics are quite sceptical of talking to the mainstream media. They've seen their work misrepresented or over-sensationalised. And so the trust between the two has broken down. And so the partnership that we create is very important to that.
I wonder, do you think there is a bifurcation then in terms of media between kind of the open access journalism that we're seeing from, you know, the likes of yourself, The Guardian, a bunch of places that make that public access very central to their message, and the hard paywalled organisations who are sort of saying, well, actually, no, that news and that content needs to be paid for? Is there almost a forking path here where both are viable methods?
Information is valuable, and again, one of the questions I slightly wrestled with when I started this job was to do with the fact that we were giving away our content for free. That if you come to the site, you don't see any ads. There's no paywall. We also publish everything under a Creative Commons license, which means you can republish it for free. Yeah. So the 100 million reads I mentioned earlier on, I think that particular month, a third of those reads came from other publications, and that ranges from the BBC to Le Monde, the Washington Post, El País, publications all over the world. And sometimes I worry, does that mean if we're giving it away for free, it has no value? And I think that particularly with our charitable status and our charitable mission, which is to take this knowledge, which is locked away in the brains or laboratories of universities in particular, and bring that to the public in an accessible way, that there is no way our content could ever be justifiably locked away behind a paywall.
See, I think what's quite interesting as well is that you were talking about engagement there, and I know that you've shared some numbers about how kind of open rates and the number of people who've signed up to the daily newsletter. Mm-hmm. So 72,000 people, of whom a third open it every day. To what extent then is the strategy of the newsletter driven by the news cycle, and how much of it is driven by actually wanting to give your readers a new way to engage with and consume your articles?
It's a real blend. So I'm going to take a step back. The kind of stories that we publish essentially fall into two categories. The first is, as you mentioned, things that emerge directly from the news cycle. And in that space, we always say we don't do breaking news. It's more like a news magazine. We provide analysis 24 hours after a story's happened, providing a particular expert perspective on what's happening. And then the other half of the content we produce is entirely original and coming directly out of research. And so that might be an academic paper that's being published somewhere like Nature, and that will be read by a few dozen of the immediate peers of the academics involved. And so they want to write with us because it allows them to reach tens of thousands of people in a different sort of space. When it comes to the newsletter, I talked earlier on about trying to sort of capture and engage with the first time readers, and in some ways, we are clearly, this is something common to very, very many publishers, but essentially it's a funnel that we take our first-time readers, whether those are someone who's encountered a story somewhere else, they've seen it on the BBC, they've seen it in the Daily Mail, The Sun, wherever, Huffington Post, and perhaps they've clicked through to read the story on our site, and then we want them to come back. Perhaps they remember us in their address bar, or perhaps they'll subscribe to the newsletter. And by appearing in their news, in their inbox each day, we can give them a curated selection of, here are some perspectives on the news, something that's quite topical, something that will capture their imagination, hopefully get them to open it, but also presenting them with things that they won't see anywhere else, the really distinctive stories that we have. And so it's finding that blend between the two and building a relationship with them as you sort of move them through that funnel that, happening in about 90 minutes as we speak, we're doing our first online panel discussion, which we made available to people through the newsletter. It wasn't advertised on the site. And ultimately, I've mentioned before that we're a charity, encouraging those people who really like us to donate and support us that way. And so it's really starting to try to build a relationship with the readers, so that they're not someone who comes to us through Google and then disappears and we never hear from them again, but becoming someone that they go to for a perspective on the news, or to learn things that they wouldn't learn elsewhere.
And you mentioned the online panel, which, good luck for that, and you've mentioned podcasts as well. Is that all in service then of building that relationship and hopefully getting them to the point of, I suppose, supporter status?
I think the kind of publication that we are, we will always have people who come in, read one article and go away. I think that's inevitable. I don't think we could ever be a one-stop shop for all of your news, if nothing else, as I say, that we don't do breaking news.
Yeah.
But certainly we want to grow those relationships so that we are part of the handful of news sources that people perhaps come to regularly when they want to learn more about a particular topic. But clearly it is very important to make sure that our content is findable in a lot of places. It's again one of the reasons that I think the open access Creative Commons model of publishing, which again you could look at and say, is that a problem? Should we be making the content feel more exclusive, that you can only find it if you come to our site? And actually, again, in spirit of our charitable purpose, it's better that we say the content goes to wherever our audiences are. One of the things that I think sometimes surprises some of our authors is that The Sun is a regular republisher of our stories, yeah, because they don't naturally think of that as a place that academics would be writing in their own words. But in fact, the digital editor of The Sun approached us and said, we'd really like to use some of your content. Can we do that? And I mean, the first thing I said, well, it's Creative Commons. You don't even need to ask for our permission. But it was nice that they did. And so actually, we've got a great relationship with them. And this is not just about The Sun spotting a story, pulling a quote out and writing their own piece, which, of course, they can and do as well. But actually, an academic writing in their own words in The Sun. And that's something really powerful that we're able to enable thanks to that open access Creative Commons model.
Are there ever concerns internally about the context in which those, you know, the Creative Commons licenses then, the Creative Commons content rather, is taken and presented elsewhere? Or are there, does the Creative Commons license itself kind of guarantee that the context remains intact, even if it has been republished?
We sometimes ask questions that I know one of the authors got in touch with us a year or two ago when one of the stories was published on Breitbart. And they said, oh, you know, that makes me really uncomfortable. And we took a look at it, and Breitbart had complied with all of our policies, that the article was unchanged. It contained links back to us. It had correct attribution. That it even included the sort of the pixel tracker that we use to measure readership. And so it is always a bit of a tension that you say, if a story ends up in a publication that, you know, might run counter to some of your values. But actually, we, you know, the argument we made was that this means the readers on that site are seeing a perspective which perhaps challenges them. They haven't distorted the content, they haven't edited it. And so I think that although that can occasionally be uncomfortable, and it's very, very rare that something like that happens, ultimately it's good that the high quality information is out there, and it's better that we're challenging misperceptions. Obviously, if someone breaches the license, if they edit the story, if they add a distorting headline or something like that, then we will get in touch with them and make them either take it down or, you know, make sure they're complying with the license. But generally, most publishers are pretty good at that.
Have you seen your demographics shift in terms of who's, you know, signing up to the newsletter, or have you found that the audience itself has kind of maintained a very, you know, broad base?
Our readership has always been a bit younger, I think, than other news publishers. I think more than 50% is under 49. Last time I checked the stats, but I think that certainly making the stories available in lots of places is helpful. Sometimes I think we should perhaps be doing more on some of the new platforms as a way of bringing readers in, although quite what an academic communicating their research on TikTok would look like, I don't know.
That's worth an experiment just to see.
But sadly, I mean, it does mean the readership of our stories is very, very global. That I know, and the republication is very, very global. The newsletter, we know, is a bit more UK centric, and when it comes to donations, it's even more UK centric, and so it's sort of concentric circles going out from the core of what we do. Again, unsurprisingly, given our the content and the academics we work with, there is a disproportionate number of people with advanced degrees, for example, amongst our readership. But I think that that's, again, it's because people in the academic world recognise the value of what we do, and they really want to champion it and share it with their colleagues and friends and networks.
And then I suppose as a penultimate question, what do you then see as being the biggest opportunities for the conversation, either in terms of audience growth or in terms of, you know, funding, or even if they're, you know, divisible from one another, because contributions could well be sort of a huge focus for you, I don't know.
Yes, so I mean, I'll take that last bit first, that we've always allowed people to donate to the conversation as a charity, but until about 2 years ago, that wasn't something that we were particularly focused on. And it was, in some ways, we've been following the lead of the conversation in Australia, which was the founding edition back in 2011, which this year has raised more than $1 million Australian from its readers, and have set themselves a target to, I think in the next 5 years, bringing in about 50% of their income from readers. By comparison, you know, we've managed to increase our reader donations from about 4% of our income up to about 8% this year, which is absolutely something significant, and I'm really proud of. But you know, we're not quite in that order of magnitude yet. There are multiple reasons for that I think there is much more of a market failure when it comes to high quality journalism in Australia. And then if you read the Reuters digital news report, there's just a higher tendency in certain markets to donate to media organisations than you get in the UK. What does that mean for the future of the organisation? Part of it does come back to the two avenues for growth that I mentioned earlier on. One is growing readership, trying to grow awareness in the UK, because I am aware that I could stop, you know, 100 people on the street and only a handful of them would have heard of us, even though the stats would suggest, in fact, a far higher number probably had read some of our stories somewhere at some point.
Yeah.
So trying to make sure things are packaged and targeted for the right audiences, as well as building relationships with other news organisations to make sure that not only people find our content, but our content finds people. And then growing the relationships we have with universities that are, you know, as I said at the start, we work with more than 75 UK universities, virtually all of the research intensive universities in the UK. And in the last couple of years, we've added around a dozen European universities to that. So Trinity College Dublin, Stockholm University, Utrecht University in the Netherlands. Mm. And I think there's a real opportunity to engage with top tier European research universities, because their academics, their universities want to engage with the public. And also we want to bring that knowledge to not only the UK public, but to our readership globally, that it's ultimately about finding the best expertise, the best research. And ultimately that means having the relationships with the universities.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that the conversation is going from strength to strength. And if people come to the website, they can check out the stories and get a sense of the kind of things that we cover. That I think sometimes people are put off by the idea that they think the content we publish is going to be very, very dry, very, very academic. And they start reading one or two stories and they suddenly find themselves going, actually, this is really interesting. This is exactly the kind of stuff that I'd like to read more of. And so if you find yourself in that camp, try subscribing to the newsletter, try checking out the podcast. We're just coming to the end of our own podcast series called Recovery, which has picked six moments in the past where humanity was really threatened or really disrupted, and looking at how we rebuilt from that moment. We'll point out that we launched that a few weeks before the BBC published their very similar series. So we got there first on that one.
Nice.
So yeah, I would encourage people to check out that. I think the event we've got this afternoon, which I say will be in the past by the time this goes out, I think will be the first of many.
Very nice. And then other than the sort of that series, you know, what is the one piece of media that you'd really like to recommend that the Media Voices audience checks out? It could be a film, it could be a book, it could be a game, it could be absolutely anything at all.
Sure. So one of the things that I've really been missing since lockdown and everything else started has been live theatre, that my wife and I spend far too much time, far too much money going to the National and other theatres. And so we've been, to the best we can, making do with the various online streams and so on that lots of theatres have put on. And those have been a real testament to the ingenuity of a lot of those sort of organisations. And there's been lots of really great performances. The one that really surprised me, and the one that I'll recommend, was a production of Much Ado About Nothing from last year at the Open Air Theatre in Central Park in the US. And my wife's American, and I will normally say my views on Americans doing Shakespeare is not great. We have disagreements on that, but I have to say, this particular production was just wonderful. It was incredibly contemporary, very American in the best way. You know, I'll leave it to your audiences to see what I mean by that. But it's you can stream it on the PBS websites under their great performances series. But you know, Much Ado About Nothing is a terrific play, and I've probably seen it a dozen or more times. Lots of different takes, lots of different versions. I won't say that, there's no bad way of doing it, but it's a great piece. But this was really distinctive, very different from a take I've seen before, and so I highly recommend that.
So that is it from us at Media Voices until September now. But the media world still continues to turn each day and cause chaos, so make sure you sign up to our daily newsletter, which we will be continuing. If we can find stories that aren't time-walled, to keep up with the key goings on each day. So you can sign up to that at voices.media. There's a friendly little pop-up box. Or we post each morning's edition to our Twitter. So if you can go to Twitter at Media Voices Pod, and yeah, you'll see our daily edition there.
And if you want to make sure that we've got a coffee while we're on holiday, go to the website, find that little button for the coffee, Ko-fi, give us your money button. And you can contribute to be part of the Media Voices journey. You can buy us a virtual coffee, we'll save them up and buy a beer.
Well, until we're next back in a couple of weeks with a fantastic guest, please do stay safe.
Wear a mask, for Christ's sake.